Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Quickly checking Valley traffic, the 303 northbound, a crash at the US 60 Grand Avenue. Also be aware of flooding around the valley after this morning's storms, including on State Route 51 southbound at McDowell. We could see some more rain before the afternoon is out. 30% chance of rain this afternoon. Look for a high of 103. 20% chance of storms tomorrow with overnight lows in the mid-80s. We should dry out for the weekend with highs right around 106 or 107 both days. Right now in Phoenix, it's cloudy and 91 degrees. The Arizona Board of Regents Health Affairs Committee is at this hour holding the first of two meetings to discuss operations at the University of Arizona Medical Schools. Earlier this summer, the Arizona Medical Association called for an investigation into the Phoenix Med School after a number of senior managers, including the school's dean, left. Regent Ram Krishna chairs the Health Affairs Committee. He's also an orthopedic surgeon. I spoke with him earlier today before this afternoon's meeting and asked him what he's expecting to hear today.
We are making sure that the quality of institutions is positive. The outcomes for the state students in our state should be perfect. So that's what our goals are, to find out what's happening with the universities, especially University of Arizona Medical Schools.
As somebody who is a part of the medical community, what concerns do you have about the U of A medical schools?
The concern I have is the turnover of the staff that we just recently had. As you know, the dean of the medical school had to leave. We need to find out why he left. And also, you know, we need to find out whether we are filling in the appropriate positions for the medical school here in Phoenix. We want to make sure that the LCME accreditation people are satisfied with our policies and procedures.
What are some of the options? I mean, you are somebody who has been around hospitals for a long time. What are some of the options for why that many people would leave one institution at roughly around the same time?
What I understand was the dean left and apparently his staff also joined him. We need to make sure the exit interviews are being done now. We need to make sure that they left because they were unhappy or they were happy. What's going on? Because they did a good job. The dean, Flynn, who left us, I think did a wonderful job. But as usual, I was told that when the dean leaves, he takes his staff with him. So they're trying to replace that with the necessary people.
I would imagine that would make it a bit more of a challenge as opposed to just having to replace the dean. You're having to replace basically the entire leadership team.
That's their problem, and I agree with you 100%. It's a big challenge, but they're doing it pretty decently, I think. They're trying to fill in the dean's positions. There's an acting dean now, and he also has department chairs that's been already looked into, and they've appointed four or five people already as department chairs, so they're working on it.
Are you satisfied that the education, that the school itself is continuing okay during this transition period, that students aren't losing out because of this?
I'm very pleased with the turnover not affecting the students. Students are still getting a wonderful job, and they're also getting into university for graduate medical education, that is residencies. They're all getting into good programs altogether. So I'm very pleased with not jeopardizing the quality of education that the kids are getting.
So after today's meeting, you'll have another meeting next week in Tucson. What happens after these two meetings? What are the next steps?
Good question. What we plan to do is compile both the information that we have from the meetings here and also in Tucson. And Banner, his main issues in Tucson is the financial dealings that they have with Banner. The quality of education is not an issue in both universities, I think, both the medical schools rather, not the universities. So it's a fact-finding mode, and we'll respond to concerns after this interview is conducted. And what we'll do is we'll advise the staff to give us some thoughts, and the full board will hear it when we finish our deliberations.
Would you imagine that would be sometime in the fall?
Yes.
Ram Krishna is a member of the Arizona Board of Regents and chair of its Health Affairs Committee. That panel is meeting this afternoon to talk about the University of Arizona Colleges of Medicine. We spoke earlier today.
It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody, along with Phil Latzman.
Well, 1 year ago, Mark, an EPA contractor conducting a cleanup operation at the Gold King Mine in Colorado inadvertently triggered a release of toxic wastewater into the Animas River.
That water contaminated many of the waterways the Navajo Nation depends on for farming.
And joining us now is Scott Smith, who is Chief Technology Officer for Water Defense. That's a nonprofit group that investigates water disasters such as the one that took place on August 5th, 2015. So, Scott, what has your testing found as a result of that big spill?
We're the only ones I'm aware of that tested what we call the baseline sediment, unimpacted pre-spill, and the post-spill impacted sediment. And what it found was, you know, a threefold increase in hydrocarbons, you know, 30% increase in barium, beryllium that was not present pre-spill, about a 20% increase in chromium, 20% increase in manganese, 20% increase in lead, and, you know, a few other chemicals of concern.
So what long-term will that do to the area where the spill occurred, the Animas into the San Juan Rivers and the beds along those rivers?
Well, that's a great question, and one of the most important points for the public to understand is when these metals go into solution, something called this pH, and when the pH changes, they precipitate out and go into the sediment. So from this Gold King mine spill, that contamination may be out of the water in the interim, but any changing pH condition or a disruption in that sediment or the bottom of the river recontaminates the water used by the Navajo to irrigate their crops, and many of them use in their, you know, daily consumption for bathing.
So this is something that the Navajo Nation is going to be dealing with for a long time.
Yes, and they have been dealing it for... unfortunately, you know, I've done a lot of work out there, and the people in the Navajo Nation are great, fantastic people, and they really understand, and they have been repeatedly impacted, and last year just highlighted it to the general public. But this is an ongoing systemic contamination that needs to be diagnosed properly and then remediated.
The Shiprock chapter of the Navajo Nation voted to open the water channel from the San Juan to irrigate their crops. You just talked about the testing that was involved there. How concerned are you that they've gone ahead and decided to use this potentially contaminated water?
They asked me to attend that meeting. That is a very, very complicated decision, and it needs to be monitored on an ongoing basis, and I believe they are doing that. It's just not an easy answer, and the real solution is for constant monitoring, and the Navajo Nation deserves to know what is in their water with appropriate science.
And Scott, the EPA, of course, is taking the blame for this, and what have they done since to try and make sure this kind of thing never happens again, where we have millions of gallons of toxic sludge coming out of these old mines?
Well, as far as I know, once the metals precipitated out of the water and went into the sediment, the EPA declared the water safe. You know, technically, if you're not testing the sediment, and that's the problem in this country with water testing, if you don't do thorough, systematic, regular testing, you can, depending on who you are, you can manipulate it to get results when water is declared clean.
You know, and Senator John McCain has called for a criminal investigation. Is that the appropriate response, or was this, you know, just an accident? Really wasn't anybody's fault.
You know, this really doesn't belong in politics and calling for investigations. It's pretty simple. We have a Clean Water Act in this country. It just needs to be enforced. And the great people at the EPA just need to be allowed to do their job. What we need to do is decontaminate the politics in this country and just let the EPA do their job and diagnose it. And as far as the whole spill, I mean, this is kind of legacy contamination that the EPA inherited. You know, I try to be very fair when you look at all these different events as to the best way to summarize it is the past generations have kicked the can down the road. So it's time to stop the blame game and deal with the can and diagnose the problem and solve it once and for all.
Scott Smith is Chief Technology Officer for Water Defense, a nonprofit group that investigates water disasters 1 year after the Gold King mine spill. Scott, thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks.
And that's KJZZ's Phil Latzman. Tomorrow is the general effective date. That basically means that most laws that were passed during the last legislative session that didn't have a specific date to go into effect by the time you'll wake up in the morning tomorrow. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services is with me to talk about some of these. And so, Howie, I was thinking that to celebrate the general effective date, maybe you and I should have a potluck.
Oh, definitely. And we can legally do it now.
Yes.
Without it being connected to work. It was a funny quirk in state law. I mean, generally speaking, if you're having food, you know, you want the health department to know that you're not giving everyone some sort of weird bug. But there was always an exception for non-commercial events. And that was presumed, though, to be simply office potlucks. But what happened is some group out in Apache Junction figured out, well, wait a second, the health department is here saying we cannot have a neighborhood potluck. So they said, why is that? And concluded, look, you know, you pays your money, you takes your chances, so to speak. You're going to a neighborhood potluck. You're not expecting the health department to be there checking who cooked what, where, what did they mix in it, and was it kept at the proper temperature. So potlucks are now legal.
And if you're having a potluck, it sounds like you can also, there's more of an option to get liquor at it.
Oh, definitely. Right now, if you want certain kinds of wines that your local store doesn't have, you've got to basically make a trip to California. Now, this is interesting because there are certain wines that are specialty wines that are not shipped in here. And what it's had to happen until now is you literally needed to go to the winery, place your order, have them mail it back to you or FedEx it back to you. Now you'll be able to call the winery and have up to 6 cases initially. Eventually it's going to be 12 cases of this specialty wine shipped to you.
In the world of education, lawmakers this past year approved a law that basically said the state has to come up with a menu of assessments. It's not just AZ Merit that schools have to offer now. Is that right?
And that's a part of the ongoing fight over Common Core, because AZ Merit is linked to Common Core. The fight initially was to eliminate Common Core, eliminate AZ Merit. Well, Common Core has become Arizona's standards, and they just renamed it, and they're tweaking with it a little bit. And this seems to be a middle ground for schools to say, well, look, we're not sure that AZ Merit tests what we want to. We're not even sure in some cases whether it's strict enough. So the State Board of Education is going to have to come up with some standards. Now, one of the interesting things in here is, how do you compare school district to school district if they're not using the same standards? And one of the interesting requirements out of this is going to be that the Board of Education is going to have to find a way of normalizing it, for lack of a better word, so that if Scottsdale Unified School District uses one standard and Phoenix Union High School District uses another, that you'll be able to say how student A is comparing to student B.
Howie, among all the other laws that will be taking effect tomorrow, what are the ones that you think are going to have the most impact that Arizonans will really notice the most?
Well, it's hard to say. Obviously, if you're a wine lover, that wine shipment is going to have an effect. What's of most notice is the legislative perennial efforts to keep cities from enacting their own laws. So, for example, Phoenix and Tempe have had ordinances about pet store sales. They're supposed to not be able to sell commercially bred animals. Well, that's being preempted with some language being put in there to say, well, if it's USDA approved and everything else, that's fine. We're also making sure that cities cannot enact any sort of gun regulations, and they're putting some teeth on it to the point that you could actually lose your state revenue sharing, which can be 30-40% of a city's budget. And so that not only affects things like, gun regulation. For example, Bisbee decided, we should have California-style laws that say plastic bags, you want one, you pay a nickel, and that'll keep you from using a lot of them. Well, we're trying to preempt that, too. These are the kinds of things that I think long-term will have some effect, because to the extent that people like to go to their city council as somebody they can reach and say, we need a law this way, minimum wage, anything like that, this is designed to preempt that.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
I'm going to enjoy watching the new laws take effect. And then, of course, as always, there'll be the corrections next year to the things that they screwed up.
It's been one of the more bizarre weeks in the history of political campaigns, with Donald Trump sinking in the polls after making a series of controversial comments. Right in the middle of it all has been Arizona Senator John McCain, who reiterated his support for the Republican nominee despite Trump's failure to endorse his reelection and his previous comments saying McCain wasn't a war hero because he was caught and spent 5.5 years as a prisoner of war in Vietnam. KJZZ's Phil Latzman spoke with Senator McCain earlier today.
Well, sir, good to see you. Nice to have you here. I want to spend as little time
Thank
as possible.
On Trump.
How'd you know that was going to happen?
I know what's in the news.
Several congressmen. One congressman, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, said that he was an American before he was a Republican and therefore could not support Donald Trump. Some in your party have already said they'd cross the line. Your own Senate colleague, Jeff Flake, said this week, told us on KJZZ, somebody's got to push back on his behavior. Wouldn't that be you?
Haven't you seen what I pushed back about the Khan family? Haven't you seen that? Did you happen to see that?
Yes, I did.
You did? Okay, then you wouldn't be asking the question.
But if you
had seen it, you wouldn't be asking the question about whether I had pushed back on Trump, or you're ignoring what I did, which I think is not good journalism.
But I think that people wonder.
I am running my own campaign, and I'm concerned about my own campaign.
Right.
And your view of what people think is fine with me.
But these aren't my views.
But I'm not going to. They are entitled to their opinion as well, and I respect their opinion as well. But I have said I'm not interested in seeing Hillary Clinton as president of the United States and losing the United States Senate. It's interesting to me that the media that has attacked me constantly, i.e. the New York Times, is now the one that's telling me to do the right thing. Thank you very much, New York Times. But I can tell you, I am running my own campaign. I have said I will support the nominee of the Republican Party, and I am supporting the nominee. But that has nothing to do with the people of Arizona that I'm asking to send me back to the Senate, based on my record of service to the state of Arizona, not anything to do with Donald Trump.
Senator, our listeners wrote us to say they were concerned about immigration reform.
Mm-hmm.
One with the handle Mess in AZ5 on Twitter asks how the Gang of Eight is doing with immigration reform, and if you are reelected, will there be any movement on that?
Well, there has to be movement sooner or later on it, because there's 11 million people who are in this country illegally, and most Americans support a tough but fair path to citizenship. But again, Barack Obama had 60 votes in the United States Senate, an overwhelming majority in the House of Representatives when he came to the presidency. So he had 2 years, 2009, 2010. Did he take up immigration reform? No. He went for a stimulus package. He went for Obamacare. He went for Dodd-Frank. So the person who your caller or email should be blaming, Barack Obama, who could have passed immigration reform the same way that he passed the Obamacare with nothing but Democrat votes. So you want to blame somebody that we haven't had a real comprehensive approach to immigration reform? Stop at the doorstep of Barack Obama and the Democrats.
Also, Senator, from our social media queries, a lot of people asked about, and you alluded to this earlier, about whether the Senate will ever get to nominating Merrick Garland this year to the Supreme Court. Laura on Twitter asked this: why is he refusing to consider Garland for SCOTUS, instead choosing to keep the vacancy for Trump to fill? And then Tim, via email, asked a similar question: why is he committed to holding a Supreme Court seat for Trump when a well-qualified and able judge has already been appointed by the president?
Well, I don't think that this is either well-qualified judge. In fact, I think he's far very left of center. But again, I believe that this is an issue for the next president of the United States, whoever that president is. And I can assure you this, that I believe that Trump would make one heck of a lot better selection than Hillary Clinton would. We know who Hillary Clinton would select, another far-left individual on the lines of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and others on the left.
And many have also wondered, Senator McCain, what's left for you to accomplish if you're reelected for another six-year term. Here's Amy on Facebook who sent us this. The biggest complaint about Congress is that nothing gets done. My question for Senator McCain is, what does he hope to accomplish in his next term, and what steps will he take to urge others to actually get meaningful legislation passed and to increase the likelihood of Congress working again?
Well, the fact is that I am the chairman of the Armed Services Committee. We have completed the Defense Authorization Bill that provides for the equipment, training, and capabilities of this nation to defend itself in times when it is under more attack than any time since 9/11. I am proud of my leadership, and I say with immodesty that I am acknowledged to be the most important senator in the United States Senate on national security. I think Arizonans care about that. And I have accomplished many things for Arizona.
And finally, things are so partisan these days.
Yep.
In all of your years of politics, can you ever remember a time where things have been so polarized on one side and the other?
I have not. I have not, and I'm sorry about it. I refer back to the Armed Services Committee. We act in a near unanimous fashion. The senior Democrat on the committee and I are not only good friends, but we work together, and we always get a defense authorization bill completed and signed by the president, and that is unfortunately sort of the exception rather than the rule, and it is unfortunate. And so hopefully we can, after this election, perhaps work on areas, for example, tax reform, that all of us agree on, that we could be more effective for the American people. Believe me, we're in peril. There will be a tax on the United States of America, thanks to a failed 8 years of Barack Obama's leading from behind.
Senator McCain, thank you so much
for
your time.
I always enjoy our spirited conversations, and I enjoy the emails and comments from your listeners. And may I say that we may disagree, but I respect their views, and I appreciate the fact that they're involved in the political process. That's what we should be all about.
Well, we appreciate you making the time for them and for us.
My pleasure.
That's KJZZ's Phil Latzman, and Phil joins me. Phil, Senator McCain also has a challenger in the August 30th primary.
Mark, he does. It's former State Senator Kelly Ward, and we have also reached out to her campaign with the same invitation that Senator McCain got. We hope to be able to speak with her before the primary.
New messages and new technology are coming our way to help cut electricity use during peak demand periods. A public workshop held at the state capitol yesterday included a panel of experts representing utilities, solar companies, and customers. KJZZ business correspondent Christina Estes was there and joins me to share some of the ways companies are trying to change our behavior.
Well, get ready to get personal, Mark. Let's start with APS's plan to use smart videos. They can send them to your phone or email. Here's an example they played, which should keep your attention.
Hello, Mark. Thank you for being a valued APS customer. We created this video just for you.
So in this example, the name is the only specific thing to you, Mark, but smart videos are designed to be personalized. You might get one that explains your energy usage or your bill or certain things you can do to save energy. That's the personalized angle. But there was also talk of peer pressure.
Peer pressure? How so?
Well, have you ever received a postcard or email from your utility that shows how much energy you use compared to your neighbors?
I actually have gotten some of those things in the mail before, yeah.
Well, look for that messaging to expand. A representative from a company called O-Power says most of us are competitive and susceptible to peer pressure. Charlie Buck says they will soon be launching a behavioral demand response program with APS. So during critical peak periods when it's really hot, they're going to send notifications at least a day in advance that say, hey, we're entering a critical period. Please join your neighbors to reduce demand. And here's the key. He says you must follow up and show people how they compared to their neighbors.
We've actually done a lot of experimental testing on this, And without that post-event notification, you see a significant drop in participation on the next round of events that are called.
Buck says the post-notification also includes more tips and the ability to opt out.
So, Christina, does this mean that instead of getting letters or like postcards like I get now, I could be getting calls or texts from my utility?
Yeah, it'll likely be up to you. You could choose to get texts, phone calls, emails. The goal is to get as many people to participate as possible, so they want you to choose how you want to get their messages.
So how much of an impact do these kind of peer pressure messages have?
Based on O-Power's work in California and Michigan, Buck says demand has been reduced between 2% and 4%. Again, that's during those peak periods.
Now, Christina, you also heard from a couple of technology companies yesterday. What do they have to say?
Well, Nest Labs is a company that sells a super personalized thermostat. If you want, their program can follow your schedule and adjust the AC, the heat, the lights without you having to do a single thing. Oh, except, of course, let them access your phone 24/7. For example, the company rep, Jeff Gleason, he's from Northern California. He says the software knows that his phone is in Phoenix with him, so his AC is not running while he's here.
And a representative from Tesla Motors was there talking batteries?
The technology that Tesla uses to run its cars is also being used in homes and businesses, mostly overseas, to store energy. They have a residential device called a Powerwall. Company representative Sarah Van Cleve says people want backup power. And in some places like Vermont, there are partnerships where a utility either splits the cost of the Powerwall with the customer, or it pays the customer a monthly fee. And in exchange, the utility owns the device and then uses that power when it needs it.
Lots of interesting things to keep our eyes on. Things could be coming down the pike. KJZZ's business correspondent, Christina Estes. Christina, thanks.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling GTL's Advanced Pay Automated Payment System for prepaid customers. Please have your Visa or MasterCard ready.
For families trying to stay in touch with loved ones behind bars, there is a cost. Like most prisons and jails, the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office uses a private service like GTL to facilitate phone and video calls. Yesterday, the FCC raised the rates that those companies can charge for their services. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins joins me. And Jimmy, what will this rate change mean?
Phone companies have contractual agreements with jails and prisons, and when they set up those agreements, they arrange rate charges, which can vary with each institution. Yesterday, the FCC voted to raise the rate caps for those calls.
So how much does it cost to talk with someone behind bars?
Well, at one point, in some cases, it was really expensive. Like, there were instances of inmates and families being charged more than a dollar a minute.
Yikes.
Yeah. So the FCC in 2013 moved to cap these rates and then expanded them last year. But the companies have pushed back now. So the caps have gone from 22 cents a minute to 31 cents a minute, which, you know, may not seem like a lot. But prison reform advocate Caroline Isaacs says if you're calling your loved one every day or every other day, it adds up.
We all know that it's primarily low-income people who go to prison. They can't afford lawyers. They're simply more likely to get wrapped up in the criminal justice system. So you already have a population that is struggling economically. Then you take, you know, in many cases, one or in some cases the only breadwinner, and you put them in one of these facilities and then charge those individuals and by extension their families for basic needs and programming. So that includes, in some cases, food, room and board, clothing, and in all cases, the ability to make a phone call to their loved ones. And, you know, all the research indicates that contact with family while someone is incarcerated actually increases their chances of doing better when they're released. It reduces recidivism. It maintaining those ties helps them do their time in a way that is less destructive to them mentally and emotionally. And so, you know, beyond just the injustice of charging people for, you know, something so basic, it really does, by extension, impact public safety.
The other thing to note here, Mark, is that these rate cap increases will be especially tough on those locked up in a small facility. Isaac says if you're in a rural jail with a small amount of inmates, the companies actually end up charging more for the calls than they would for a really highly populated prison.
It's a contractual arrangement, and so anytime you have a company that's seeking a contract, they have a charge, then the more people equals more money. And so if they have a huge facility with, you know, thousands of people making phone calls, a lower amount for each call is not as big a deal. But of course, if they have a smaller local facility and not as many people in it, then they consider it a loss.
And Mark, the companies are still not happy with these caps. These rate cap changes will take effect in 90 days, but there's an ongoing legal fight in the D.C. Circuit Court to actually have them completely thrown out.
That's KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Thanks, Jimmy.
My pleasure, Mark.
It's the show on 91.5. Along with The Takeaway's John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. It's with some sadness and pride that Brazilians greet the opening of the 2016 Olympics. 7 years of preparation and 7 years of political turmoil that could peak right in the middle of these games.
If the Brazilians can pull this off, they deserve a gold medal of their own. The arrival of the Olympic torch earlier in the week sparked protests by hundreds of demonstrators. Organizers report that more than 1 million tickets remain unsold. Juliana Barbosa is Brazilian-born and the author of Dancing with the Devil in the City of God, Rio de Janeiro on the Brink. She spoke to me from Rio just outside the Maracana Stadium where the opening ceremonies will take place, and she said there's no hiding the grim realities in Brazil right now with a few Olympic flags.
The problems are not going anywhere. I mean, the recession is upon us. The president will be facing an impeachment trial before the end of the month, and you know, as I stand here looking at the stadium where the opening ceremony will take place tonight, there is a river of sewage that runs between me and the main door. So there is no more time to deal with any of that. This is the way that Rio's Olympics are going to go down.
Nevertheless, is there going to be a sense of escape, of pause from all the problems of Brazil while these games are happening? Or are Brazilians basically just hoping no disaster happens?
Brazilians are very proud of their country. They want Brazil to look good on television. They want people who have come here to feel comfortable. But security is an issue. Some athletes have had problems with robberies and things like that. The quality of the water in which some of the competitions are going to be held is also a problem. We're just keeping our fingers crossed that nothing bad will happen. But I don't think that there is a sense of pause, in all honesty. The president will face impeachment before this month is over. So it's very difficult for Brazilians to disconnect right now from the things that are weighing on them.
Well, careful viewers of the Olympics, what should they take away then as they watch the competition? But they're also going to see signs of everything you've described.
One of the biggest legacies, ironically, of the Rio Olympics is going to be a real questioning of the model of the current Olympics. The athletes deserve focus on them, and the people of the host cities deserve an Olympic Games that is affordable and sustainable. And I think this trend that we've seen towards ever bigger, ever more expensive games is failing on both those counts.
And describe the state of transportation, because of the infrastructure that was going to be built for the games that would matter, would actually live beyond the games. It was the light rail systems that were going to be put in place. How are they?
There are problems with the conception of the project. The light rail system, for example, goes in a circle around the touristy port area. The other projects, the bus rapid transit routes, all connect to the west side of Rio, which is where the main Olympic cluster is. It's also the wealthiest part of Rio with the most expensive real estate. So, you know, you just question not just the expense, but the priorities. Did this money really go to where Cariocas needed it the most?
What's the likelihood that people in the east side of Brazil, or the east side of Rio, will really feel left out and, as the games go on, will get more and more angry?
We've had a cycle of big sporting events, starting with the Pan American Games in 2007 here in Rio, the World Cup in 2014, and now the Olympics. And in every case, they've seen investment here in Rio at least go largely towards the west side, not meet the needs of the poorest population, and those needs are tremendous. Before the World Cup, even, Brazilians were out in the streets in 2013, 2014, protesting these priorities and questioning their government's responsiveness to their needs. The mood is not what we had hoped for. There's not that excitement. You know, you don't see flags everywhere. And I think it's because of these broader questions.
Describe just how different it was 7 years ago when the announcement was made that the Olympics would actually come here. It really tells a tale of how quickly fortunes can change in global economics.
Brazil and Rio in 2009 were an entirely different places than they are now. You know, I'm staying now in Copacabana. I remember back in 2009, people just exploded and sort of an impromptu carnival, confetti flying, you know, partied all night after the IOC chose Rio as the host. The president at the time, Lula, was tremendously popular. He cried when he heard that the Olympics were coming to Rio. And he said things like, you know, Brazil's moment has come. You know, the world has recognized Brazil's place. Fast forward to 2016, you know, the past couple of years, we've seen massive protests also along Copacabana, you know, for the impeachment of his successor, of President Rousseff. We have seen the fortunes of the country turn around completely. As you mentioned, you know, the country is facing a deep recession. Politically, it's unstable. People feel very differently, to the point where that president, Lula, who really campaigned hard for the Olympics to come to Rio de Janeiro, isn't even going to the opening ceremonies, and neither is his successor, Dilma Rousseff.
Juliana, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Juliana Barbosa is author of Dancing with the Devil in the City of God, Rio de Janeiro on the Brink.
That's the Takeaways, John Hockenberry. Good afternoon. It's the show. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein.
More than 200 national Olympic committees will send at least one athlete to the Rio Summer Games. Arizona State by itself will have either current student athletes or former Sun Devils representing more than a dozen nations, including the U.S. Swimmer Kat Simonovic will be on Serbia's team. She and Jeremy Hawks of ASU's athletic department came in to talk to us before Simonovic left for Rio. Kat, what has it felt like to prepare and get ready, and what are your emotions right now?
You know, the Olympics comes with this huge, you know, accomplishment attached to it, and it's ultimately every athlete's dream to make it and qualify. And I think more than anything, it's been, while it's been a, you know, like a dream come true, it's also been a goal accomplished. And I like the word goal because I've been working towards this for many years now, and the fact that I finally have reached that checkpoint and hit that goal marker for me says a lot.
At what point did you feel like this was a goal you wanted to try to achieve?
After the 2012 Olympic Games, I had missed it, I want to say by 6/100ths of a second. And I knew after that moment that the training for the next games began, you know, the day after finding out that I didn't make it, because it is a long road, and it's ultimately just showing how dedicated you are day in and day out. And it's not, you know, a summer process or a year's process. You know, the journey goes back multiple years. And I think after the 2012 Olympics, I knew that there needed to be a lot more work.
So as a competitor, you're never going into these things thinking, hey, I'm happy to just be here. I mean, obviously, we've never met anybody who's like that. But what are your expectations going in? I mean, are you expecting to compete for the highest medals? Are you expecting to make a good showing and then maybe have another chance in another 4 years? What are your thoughts?
I think the goal was first to qualify to the games. So going in, I think any personal best times or any small improvements, no matter how big the margin, is definitely a bonus. But more than anything, you know, being captain next year, going into my senior year, I'm looking to just experience as much as I can and learn from the best in the world. And not just swimming wise, you know, I'm going to be surrounded by the best athletes from all around the world. So I'm really excited to learn from them and, you know, see what I can bring back and teach the future generations of their program and see where we can go.
How does it feel to represent ASU? And then also, how does it feel to represent Serbia, which I think people are, I think people might naturally assume, oh, here's an ASU student, the captain of the swim team. She must be representing the U.S., but you're not.
Honestly, I'm very proud to represent Serbia and where I come from because I'm first generation, born in America, and both sides of my family are from Serbia. So I'm literally the first one here. And so it's really cool to, you know, kind of represent my roots, but with the benefit of, you know, being a collegiate athlete and studying at one of the best universities in the world. And, you know, I think I'm very, very privileged, and I don't take a minute for granted just because, you know, even being in the United States, there's so many resources and the things ASU provides me with. I mean, my head coach, you know, Bob Bowman, it's awesome. So I get the best of both worlds ultimately. And yeah, I couldn't be more proud to represent.
So Jeremy, this is a huge university ready to have a huge impact on the Summer Games. How many athletes are representing ASU? And they're representing multiple countries, obviously, as Kat's an example of.
So we'll have 25 representatives of ASU this year. We'll have 20 alumni, 3 current student athletes, and 2 head coaches who will be coaching at the Olympics. So put that into perspective, I think at the last Olympiad, we had 18 or so and 1 current student athlete. So we're trending up. You know, it's always going to be the Stanfords, the Cals, the UCLAs, the USCs. And, you know, here we are going in this Olympiad where we're third. We're ahead of Stanford. We're ahead of UCLA. Mm-hmm. And that just kind of, you know, Ray Anderson's goal is to make this an Olympic hub. And we're already taking the steps to get there.
Are there certain sports, obviously swimming is one with Bob Bowman coming in, others that come to mind, Olympic sports that we may see growth as far as ASU is concerned?
Yeah, obviously we have a great tradition with track and field. One thing that I think is particularly impressive with track is we've had an American represent our track and field program at every Olympiad since 1952. You have wrestling where, you know, Ray brings in Zeke Jones. Zeke's a guy whose name is synonymous with USA Wrestling.
Are you looking at this long term? Are you thinking to yourself, I need to experience this and do as well as I can this time around and not even take the chance that there's going to be another opportunity?
I find myself somewhere in the middle because for a sport like swimming, you know, late 20s is already, you're already looking kind of over the hill age-wise. But, you know, I don't want to put limitations on anything because there are crazy scenarios. There are, you know, anything can happen with hard work and with a lot of dedication. So, but I definitely think going into these games, the main focus is leaving it all in that pool in Rio and seeing how far that'll take me and seeing where I can go with that. Because, again, I think at that grand stage, anything's possible and anyone has a chance behind those blocks.
Kat Simonovic is an ASU swimmer representing Serbia in the Summer Olympics. We also spoke with Jeremy Hawks of ASU's athletic department.
The lion dance is a Chinese tradition. You may have seen the large, ornate, often brightly colored lion heads at Chinese New Year festivals or other special occasions. The show's Annika Klein takes us to a lion dance in Chandler.
In front of Sifu Gourmet, 2 red lions are waking up. It looks like they're stretching and yawning as dancers under the fabric begin to stand and move. One dancer controls the head, while another controls the tail. The dim sum restaurant recently changed hands, and the new owners asked the Arizona Martial Arts Lion Dancers to perform here to bring good luck and prosperity. The lions begin by bowing to the front door.
And then if you notice, when we came in, we bowed into the cash register. Why? Because that is where the money of the establishment is coming and going.
Peter Pena is the group's teacher. The dancers work together to walk, bow, even jump on each other's shoulders to make it look like the lion is standing on its hind legs. They interact with an audience enjoying dumplings and noodle rolls. People chuckle when the lions seem to want a bite of their lunch, but Pena says every movement has a purpose.
When the whiskers go over the person's head, that means that the lion is blessing that table or that person.
After some picture taking, the costumes come off, revealing the dancers underneath.
A lot of people notice we are not Asian. Far from it.
Becky Bohannon and her husband Kevin are lion dancers.
But we are very honored to be able to take part of it. It's an amazing thing, and I'm glad we were able to share with it.
Like others in the group, they've been doing this for years, but most of the dancers don't have Chinese roots. Here's Kevin Bohannon.
Our lion dance knowledge was pretty nil, you know, just what we've seen on TV and an occasional kung fu movie.
Pena is Chinese Hispanic and has been studying lion dance for decades. While he wants to preserve the customs he was taught, he believes the art form should be open to anyone.
People still think that, a good lion dance team is mainly only Asian.
But it's not uncommon for outsiders to seek out and learn customs from other places. Ted Solis is an ethnomusicologist at Arizona State University and studies music as it relates to culture. He says as things like music and dance migrate, there's a lot to consider, like figuring out how to participate in these art forms without appropriating them.
What is our goal in all this? Are we trying to preserve the culture? Are we trying to give people a kind of an enjoyable experience? Are we trying to do both?
These are tough questions to answer. In his own student ensembles, the musicians are often not from the same background as the music they're playing.
They may not have come directly from being immersed in such a culture, but they know that it's there and they have a certain connection to it, maybe emotional or romantic connection to it, and they want to capture it.
For Kevin Bohannon, part of the joy is to connect back with the Chinese community, like he did here at Sifu Gourmet.
It feels so wonderful to be able to share their culture and to show that it spanned the boundaries of race and countries, and that's just an awesome feeling.
For the show, I'm Anika Klein.
Drummer Billy Cobham has played professionally for nearly 50 years and with some of the most famous and talented jazz musicians in history, including Miles Davis and the Mahavishnu Orchestra. He's also performed with the Grateful Dead and Jack Bruce of Cream. Cobham is in the Valley this week for two reasons, one to teach the art of the rhythm section and the other to perform Saturday night at the Mesa Arts Center, and he joins me now to talk about playing and teaching music. Bill, what does it take to be a great drummer?
Rhythm is a major part of the process, of the formula for being a great musician who plays at the drums. But you have to still be creative in a harmonic and melodic way, along with the imaginative element of phrasing. If you don't have all of them in the formula, you lose proportionately your ability to play musically in the general sense.
Is that something that someone should have a knack for at least a little bit, or can you start with almost just nothing and just work hard and get good at it?
The latter. If you really want to be a good musician, you just have to work with it. But you have to love it in order to work at it, because you have to have an idea of what you want to do. So that's the work part. You know, it makes it even, if you have an idea that's preconceived, you're going to work less. If it's something that you're sort of putting together as you go, it's going to be tougher. And so the objective is to, in the case of something like this, where you're just putting stuff together as you go, you have to do it over and over again until you get into the habit of doing it. It's about teaching the body to do certain things. On the other hand, if you preconceive and you hear it in your head, more than likely you'll probably just apply yourself and you do it once or twice and you have it.
You still love it?
It's not about love.
Okay.
It's about,
Was it ever about love?
It's a lifestyle.
Okay.
And it's beyond love. And if anything, yes, of course, love is inside it. Mm-hmm. If I'm not doing this, then what am I doing? The gift of the day, at the end of the day, is being on stage for 90 minutes approximately, enjoying the moment. The rest of the time, you pay the price to get there, which is sleeping, having breakfast, getting enough sleep so it's not, you know, you're not being tired. Otherwise, you really can't enjoy it. You know, and it all ties in to when you get on the bandstand and you play. And then you have to get off the bandstand, put everything away. That's where the job starts again. And it goes around like that until you get on the bandstand again. That's it. That's life.
Was the gift ever a burden for you? Because some artists will talk about how they feel like, boy, having this talent and having the expectations of other people can be kind of a burden. Did you ever feel that way?
Absolutely not. Everybody's different. I'm glad I never felt that way. I mean, I felt one time, the only purely emotionally negative time I ever had in my life, that then I just wanted to leave this earth. And then I realized it was the music that I hadn't finished. And I realized that it was much more worth being here to get that done. And it made me forget all about, almost in a snap. I was down for a couple of days, 2-3 days. Felt very bad. And within a couple hours, I was back. How it happened was that I started to write some things out, and one thing led to the next. And next thing you know, the end product was a couple of tunes I wrote.
How important is practice? It sounds like a basic question, but is that, if someone wants to get great at this, or at least good at this, is there that constant, you can't be taking a few days off and say, I'll get back to it later?
You practice 365 days a year, 24/7, in your brain. You cannot play on your instrument what you don't know in your head. So if you don't have the idea in your head, you're not going to go and play the instrument because you have no reason to be there. It's just pure logic. But if you have something to say, you will go to the instrument, based on what you have experienced, whether it be through a coach like myself or a teacher, and you're going to apply yourself to that. That's where you want to be.
Spectrum 40.
Yes.
So this was major creation of yours 4 decades ago.
Yeah.
What is it about what you created then that you wanted to keep revisiting?
When I wrote Stratus or Spectrum, it was from the perspective of a person who only played piano with 2 fingers. You know, it was like ping, 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 ping. You don't have to be Prokofiev to be successful. What you do have to be is sincere. 40 years later, I could take this piece and expound on it very easily, as I have done. But it took time for me to understand where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do.
Drummer Billy Cobham, who's been playing professionally for nearly 50 years, and he'll bring some of that experience to the Mesa Arts Center for a concert on Saturday night.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.